It is Free For All Friday here on the Council of Trent, and we have something returning, Ask Me Anything, something we haven't done in a while, and I have a new format for it that I think could work really well. I've been trying to find the right format for being on Catholic Answers Live. I don't want to answer the most interesting questions on Catholic Answers Live, and sometimes when we have live callers, you don't get the most interesting questions. But I know where I can get interesting questions from our patrons at TrentHornPodcast.com. And I've wanted to do Ask Me Anythings with them for a while, but I didn't see how I could fit it in with the normal production schedule for Council of Trent itself to be able to do that. But I'm excited to do this. I want it to be a rotating 1 hour a week. I'll be on Catholic Answers Live doing an interview with Cy and then taking questions just from our patrons. So if you want to ask me a question, go to TrentHornPodcast.com. I want to share with you today some of those questions that were submitted to us. I do apologize right off the bat. I am working with Catholic Answers Live to try to make the audio quality better. They have me do a particular live streaming software to record with Cy. And I don't like it because, as you'll listen to, my voice is much more compressed than it would be on the rich microphone I have here in the studio. I don't know why it's doing that. I might try to get them to use Riverside or some other program. I don't know, but I'm not sure why. Also, it's just me. It seems like nobody else has that problem. I still think they're good answers. So I want to share it with you. This is something, though, for future Ask Me Anythings, I very much want to remedy. So hope this is helpful for you all. Thank you, guys. And yeah, if you aren't, consider becoming a patron at TrentHornPodcast.com to ask me all kinds of questions for future episodes. And now, Ask Me Anything on Catholic Answers Live.
Trent, what are your thoughts on embryo adoption?
This is bad because I really should have more thoughts on this question. Mm-hmm. I'm very torn. I am actually the editor of an anthology on human embryo adoption that was just published by the National Catholic Bioethics Center. I'm one of the co-editors of the anthology. So we wrote the opening summary to the book and then organized the book that has probably something like two dozen Catholic authors in it. Jimmy Akin is actually featured in it. He offers an essay on the church's magisterial teaching on human embryo adoption, just to make it clear that the church does not have a specific teaching at this time on whether it's okay to adopt frozen human embryos who have been discarded to prevent them from just wasting away in cryopreservation. So when we're talking about human embryo adoption, that's what we're talking about in a specific, not in vitro fertilization, but human embryos left in cryopreservation and couples who adopt them solely for the good of those embryos themselves. And our authors, we have some like Father Tad Boholcek say that it is not permissible. It violates the unique duty and role of the husband to impregnate his wife and no one else. Other Catholic philosophers and ethicists and theologians saying it can be permitted for the good of the child. It's a kind of adoption, theology of adoption. Everyone involved is really split down the middle. I've read both sides. I'm still really undecided. So I take more of a practical approach. I think that even if it is permissible, if you start promoting this as a good thing, it will just serve to make people think it's okay to do IVF because the extra embryos will get adopted anyways. So from a strictly pragmatic perspective, I don't support promoting this and would like to see fewer children end up being created through in vitro fertilization. I certainly mourn those who suffer from infertility, but the inhuman things that occur when children are created outside of the safety of the womb, where they are deliberately killed in IVF labs, left in cryopreservation and storage, where they could have significant health outcomes that we're not even familiar with now as a result of being through the process of IVF. These are just other things that really need to be considered, and that children ultimately, as the church says, no one has a right to a child. A child is a gift. It is a gift from God that we lovingly accept. And it is not right for us to create children outside of the marital act.
Thanks very much, Sean. I hope that that answer addressed, it certainly seems like it did, but I hope it did address what you were looking for. Let's go to another patron question. Joseph Daly is a patron of the Trent Horn podcast, Council of Trent. What do you think is the best argument, Joseph asks, against utilitarianism? And what are some good resources to refute this normative theory? What book or resource do you think provides the best defense of natural law ethics?
Mm. Charles Rice, a while back, did a book, 50 Questions on Natural Law. And by the way, I would say that natural law, there's different schools of thought of natural law. Robert George is a proponent of the new natural law theory. You can get his books on that. Someone like Ed Fazer might be more of what you would call kind of an older traditional natural law school theorist. And both have their place within Catholic moral philosophy and theology. But you could also, even if you don't believe in natural law theory, your philosophy is not in favor of that. It doesn't follow that you should be a utilitarian. There's many other ethical theories that are out there. I think that the biggest objection to utilitarianism is that it has a misplacing of ultimate value. Utilitarian, and there's different, by the way, there's different kinds of utilitarianism as well. What the questioner is probably thinking of is act utilitarianism. This is the idea that an act is moral. An action is moral if it produces more utility than another act. And usually utility is defined in terms of well-being. Like, does it produce more well-being? Does it cause less harm? A sloppy way of doing it is to say that utilitarians believe in the maximum amount of pleasure for the greatest number of people, which those are two competing things, by the way. If you try to put it that way, it leads to all kinds of crazy. You can't do that, right? Because let's say you could increase so there's lots of people and lower happiness until it gets to a bare minimum amount. So everyone's just barely willing to live, but there's zillions of people. Or if you say, well, I want to have a society where it's the average amount of happiness is the highest, well, then we should kill this guy if he's sad, and that will increase the average. You know, there's all kinds of problems here. It misplaces the ultimate value in being in well-being and pleasure versus just persons themselves as being intrinsic sources of value. And the best way to show the problems of utilitarianism is just to show, when brought to its logical conclusions, utilitarianism leads to repugnant, immoral conclusions. It just does not account for our basic moral intuitions that we have that we can be very certain of that are true. I used to always do these thought experiments of you getting killed with abortion. I guess we can...
Skip.
I have to. I'm going to have to...
Here we go.
I'm going to... And it's going to be worse, Cy.
Yeah, go ahead.
This time, so for example, here's something utilitarianism cannot.
All right.
You know, so let's say Cy, he's no longer, people are a fan of him as a host of Catholic Answers Live. And
so we're talking about 5 years ago.
Right. He gets fired and he wanders the streets and is mm-hmm. homeless and mm-hmm. has no friends or family anymore, stumbles into a hospital. And then the doctors realize he's unconscious. Oh, we can save his life. Or wait, 5 of his organs would save 5 healthy, beloved individuals of the Catholic Answers Apologetics team. Well, utilitarianism would say that what would produce the most utility is to carve up Psy so that the other 5 members of the Catholic Answers Apologetics team and family can go on to have happy, productive lives. There's more utility there. So you could sacrifice people. Here's another one. This is another fun one. So another one where this one involves Cy and his twin brother, Guy.
Why do you say this is another fun one? That first one wasn't fun. I didn't have fun with that thing.
Well, let's see. So Cy and Guy are twin joggers, and Bob is a neighbor to them.
Yeah.
And Bob really cannot stand Cy and Guy jogging past his house every day.
All right.
One day, Bob backs out of his house, and he accidentally runs over Guy, and he's like, oh, I can't believe that happened. Then the next day he thinks, I really can't stand that other jogger, Cy. And here he comes running by, he's going to be come running by any soon. I really hope when I back out my car right now, I accidentally run over him as well. Okay. Now, if utilitarianism is true, both of these acts are either equally right or equally wrong. Okay. Because they cause the same utility, the death of a person.
Right.
But notice the intentions are very different here. In one case, you would say, well, he's a bad guy, but what he did wasn't wrong because, it was an accident. Mm-hmm. But if you say it's wrong because he caused – if it's wrong to back over Cy because he hoped for that to happen and it causes negative utility, then it's wrong to accidentally do it. So you can't take things that don't cause negative utility, like just evil thoughts a person may have, and say that those are evil. And then there's lots of other examples. Utilitarianism is a hard time explaining why we have special obligations to our own family members instead of to other people if utility is all that matters. When it comes to books on this, I would say Kara Wetiwa, the future Pope John Paul II, his book Love and Responsibility has a good section on utilitarianism, and Alistair MacIntyre's book After Virtue also has good critiques of utilitarianism. But even the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy will show you many formidable objections to utilitarianism, to act utilitarianism. That's why a lot of these guys will say, well, we're rule utilitarians. So we just follow rules that end up producing the most utility, which either makes you more of a traditional deontologist, rule-based person, or you end up having to break the rules in an emergency situation anyways, and it becomes just kind of incoherent. But that's a little bit on utilitarianism there.
Joseph, thank you. That was actually kind of nostalgic. A little trip down memory lane, Trent finding various ways to kill me on the air.
Careful when you jog down memory lane, Si.
I know. You never know. Bob. Keep an eye out for Bob. I got time for another one before we have to take a break. These are questions from Trent's patrons, Mario Rosas. Hi, Trent.
Hello.
Oh, there you go. Mario said, hi, Trent.
Hello, Mario.
All right. Yeah. How do I approach a friend who believes many of our dogmas, but feels like he's growing spiritually in his charismatic church, so he feels no need to change?
I would just ask him, what advice would you give to someone who you would want to join your charismatic church, but feels like they are growing spiritually in a non-Christian religion? So let's say you're friends with a Mormon, and you say, "Oh, you know, why don't you come to my church and be baptized and worship Jesus?" And the Mormon says, "I'm interested, but I'm just growing so much in I'm growing so much here in the Mormon church." What would you say to him? I'm sure that the charismatic guy will point out, "Oh, well, here's problems in moral theology." That even if you're growing in certain fruits of the spirit and certain virtue, you're growing certain virtues, for example, you're still missing very important things that God wants you to have. So at least for that guy, I tell him, hey, you would tell a non-Christian, even if they're growing in virtue, there's important things they're missing out on in the church, the Christian church, what you think is the true church. You would ask, Mario, you could ask your friend, do you believe Christians should belong to the church, whatever that is? What if I were to tell you, it's like the Matrix, red pill, blue pill. What if I were to tell you that the church is not just an invisible confederation or loose-knit invisible collection of all Christians, but that it has a visible, enduring hierarchy that can guide us as believers to salvation through the administering of the sacraments, and that other Christians might be connected to this church, say Protestants, for example, in imperfect ways, but we desire for all Christians to be in perfect communion with the one holy Catholic Apostolic Church that Jesus Christ established.
Mario, I hope that was helpful to you. You know what? When we get these questions in like this, you go through them pretty quick. I mean, you even murdered me a couple times, and I still have time for another question.
No, one of those was manslaughter at best. I think both of those. I think one time it was murder, but I think with the car, if I went to court, the first time you get off, I think, both of those, I think
you
barely
harvested my organs. That's while I was alive. That's murder.
That was murder. You weren't alive. We had the dignity to kill you first. My goodness, Si, come on. But for Si and Guy, the twin jogger car rolling, at best, you're going to get me on reckless indifferent to life. You're not getting me for murder.
I'm still dead either way.
You give me manslaughter 3. I'll take manslaughter 3.
Merry Christmas. Trent's killing
me
again.
5 years. Years with time served.
Nothing gets me in the Christmas spirit like Trent murdering me and then arguing for lenience from the court.
Murder is a prejudicial term here, Si. At best, you've only shown manslaughter. You've only shown homicide. Okay. Let's not poison the jury.
Trent has a new
book. Which we could also do for a thought experiment.
Trent's new book is called Salvation is from the Catholic Church, How Christ Uses the Church to Bring Us to Him. I should have mentioned it while he was giving that last answer.
For example, Si, if I did something horrible, even like kill you, I could go to confession and I could find salvation because God desires the salvation of all people.
You know, so what? If you killed me, I would want you to do that. I would want you to find salvation.
That is good. Yeah. That is good. That shows that you are in a state of grace because you have the love of God in your heart and you don't seek vengeance. You seek the good of others.
Or I was just saying it to sound good on radio. All right, we got to take a quick break.
Then you better go to confession.
Trent Horn is our guest. Merry Christmas. We got lots more questions from his patrons coming up right after this on Catholic Answers Live. Watch it on Trent's YouTube channel. As I said, all the questions are from patrons of that podcast, and this one comes from Emmanuel Cruz. Emmanuel wants to know, do you have any recommendations on trying to evangelize family members who are atheists?
Sure. And I would say it is important to remember that apologetics and evangelism are not synonyms. They are not the same thing. Apologetics and evangelism, really, they are they're distinct tools. Apologetics is often a subset of evangelism, but they're very distinct. You can evangelize someone without engaging in apologetics. Like if someone used to be Catholic but has left the faith, fallen on hard times, just telling them, hey, look, God loves you. He hasn't forgotten about you. He has a plan for your life. And you won't regret going back to God, asking for forgiveness, going to the sacrament of confession, receiving him in the Eucharist, and going to church. God loves you. Go there and just talk to him, and you won't be, you know, you won't be disappointed. Just to appeal to someone like that, that's engaging in evangelism. I mean, well, it's bringing someone who's fallen away. Evangelism technically would be sharing the good news of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, especially to people who are unbaptized. But in the looser sense of the word, you're evangelizing. And you don't have to maybe do a defense. The person might just need a spiritual kick in the pants. But apologetics, you could do that even someone who fully believes the faith. You say, hey, you know, you're troubled by this. Let me give you some reasons to help you with that. So when it comes to evangelizing atheist family members, a lot of it isn't so much having the best arguments, which are important to have, but having just like the right kind of mannerism. St. Paul in Letter to the Corinthians says, if I have all knowledge, but I don't have love, I'm a resounding gong. So I think what you can do is just be inviting, like inviting them to Catholic functions where, you know, maybe not a mass if they want to go. Say, hey, do you want to come to mass with me? Well, I'm an atheist. Why would I go? Oh, you know, especially like Christmas mass, for example, or to Easter, just to come with and, you know, to see what it's like, or to an event at your parish that's a bit more maybe low stakes and not as liturgical, what we would call pre-evangelization. When it comes to having conversations, not trying to beat somebody in a debate, but just like asking them questions, saying like, okay, you know, so if you're an atheist, do you think there is no God, or you just think there's, you don't have a good reason to believe in God? So it's more of an I don't know, like asking questions and then saying, you know, what do you think about these are things, like sharing your testimony to say, hey, these are the things that I find really interesting that point to God for me. What would you think of that? So once again, you're not debating the person. You're asking them what they think. You're sharing your testimony. And in sharing your testimony, maybe you're sharing an argument you find compelling. Maybe you could share a debate with them and say, hey, you want to watch this debate and see what you think of it? Like the debate I had with Alex O'Connor on atheism back on Pints with Aquinas many years ago. That was a really good debate. Say, what do you think about this? That's another route. But ultimately, you want to keep the door open, pray for the person, be inviting, and just be open to God wherever the role you're going to have with that person. Maybe you aren't the one that's going to make the light bulb go off for them, but you plant a seed that somebody else will water and will flourish. But pray for them, offer, just as I said, just try to keep the door open when you're engaging these conversations, and you don't want to rush things. Just treat them with the dignity they have as a person.
Emmanuel, thank you very much for your support of Trent and for your question. This one comes from another patron of Trent Horn's podcast, Rachel Perez, and Rachel asks this. Hi, Trent.
Hello, Rachel.
I feel like I have to do that part. I need to get the response from you. What does Pope Leo's statement on not using the title of Mary as co-redemptrix mean for the direction of the church? Why was that statement important? As a new convert, I am unsure of the importance of the Mater Populi Fidelis letter, and I wondered if you could help me understand.
Sure. So the letter itself, it comes from the Dicastery for the Doctrine of the Faith, the DDF, previously the CDF, previously the Holy Office. I love AKA, AKA. So it comes from there. And Cardinal Fernandez, the head of the DDF, has clarified the meaning of this document. And it's doctrinal notes on what kind of language the church uses in reference to Mary. And he was very clear that the church has not put out some kind of a ban on lay Catholics describing Mary with terms like co-redemptrix, which is a term that has been used previously. Popes have used it, theologians have used it, to describe Mary's unique role in God's plan of redeeming the world, that her cooperation with God, cooperating with God in the Annunciation by saying yes and freely allowing herself to bear the Son and giving up her maternal rights so that her Son would die on the cross to redeem the world, she cooperated with God's plan to redeem humanity. But that does not mean that she redeemed humanity in the same way that Christ did, so that they are both equally redeemers, or Mary is not another redeemer, as one Reformed Baptist apologist likes to claim in a book he wrote about Mary many, many years ago that I've responded to in my own works. So it's not like if you call Mary co-redemptrix at home when you're praying, it's not like the Pope Mobile is going to show up at your house with blue and red lights flashing and they're going to burst down your door and the Inquisition is going to show up and discipline you. Though I imagine if they did show up, though, I hope the siren, though, it would not be the normal siren. It would be the European police siren. Wee! You know, the European ones. I'm always like, is Jason Bourne on the run? What is going on here? I hear the European police sirens, because it has to be for the Pope Mobile. No, but the document does say, though, that for the purposes of ecumenism, for the purposes of not creating unnecessary doctrinal barriers, the term is not going to be used in official church documents, documents promulgating the teaching of the church. And that's important because the term itself, it can be so often misunderstood. If a term can be misunderstood so easily, and it's not strictly necessary to preserve an important dogma. So, for example, the term Theotokos, or to calling Mary the Mother of God, is a dogmatic term, a term that is used. Many Protestants misunderstand it. But the clarification of that term, I would say, is well worth it, because it secures a very central and key truth of the faith, that not all doctrines are equally weighted. There is what is called a hierarchy of truth. So, for example, Christ rising from the dead is more essential faith, a more essential article of faith than Christ ascending into heaven. While Christ ascending into heaven is important, Christ rising from the dead, if Christ is not risen, your faith is in vain, as Paul would say. So there's going to be some truths that are more central, and as we go out more, there are going to be ones that are less central. So the truth that Jesus is God is a really central truth to the Christian faith. If you deny that, you're not Christian. So saying Mary is the mother of God is an integral element of upholding that Christ was divine throughout his entire life. He didn't just become divine later at his baptism, as some heretics said in the early church. But the term co-redemptrix causes even more confusion than the term Mother of God, and there isn't as central of a doctrine that is necessary to secure in using that term, namely the doctrine that Mary participated in a special way with Christ in Christ's redemption of the world. So it's not worth it to cause all of this undue hardship and misunderstandings and barriers to outreach to non-Catholics in that circumstance. So I hope that's helpful. And also, my colleague Joe Heschmeyer, I think, has a whole episode about this on his channel, Shameless Popery, that I would commend you to watch if you would like some more on that.
Horn's our guest. It's kind of a relaxed feel. I hope you're relaxed wherever you are. Thanks for joining us on this day after Christmas. And we got all the questions are in. They're from patrons of Trent's show, Shameless Trentery. No, what's it called? It's called Council of Trent. Council of Trent. You can find it at councilofTrent.com. You can find out all about it. This question comes from one of your patrons named Skabanik. Skabanik. How do you think I'm doing with that? Skabanik?
Skabanik.
Okay. Oh, all right. That might even better. Oh, this is a hard question. Settle in. How's Laura?
Oh, thank you for asking. Laura and I always joke that there is a particular sort of cadence that young, attractive girls of a certain socio-demographic will say when they say thank you. It doesn't always come off as being really genuine. It's almost a little Valley Girlish. So a lot of times with Deuce 7, we'll say, "Oh, thank you." So imagine this particular 19-year-old college girl, certain demographic and social status, her Starbucks in hand, trying to be polite but not really, and say, you know, so the response is, "Oh, thank you," and then trying to like leave the situation. So that is my my reply to that. Genuine thank you for asking. It's getting there. That is my reply. It is getting there.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, it was my wife was diagnosed with a tumor, brain cancer, back in May. Then she underwent surgery to remove the tumor in July, and it's been a hard road, but she's really come a long way. The tumor was around her speech center. It was like, I don't know, like an inch by inch and a half, or an inch by half an inch. It was not tiny, not huge, thankfully. We caught it early. So it was removed. We did the pathology report on it, and it seemed to be basically like a grade two, like something that almost a grade one, something where you wouldn't have to really worry about it. There's always still risk it could come back, but we got the most favorable diagnosis from it. But that said, though, when you take away parts of somebody's brain, weird things will happen. Like when she was first in the hospital after the surgery, I feel like she had maybe 100 or 200 words at best, maybe 100. I don't know. There was a lot she could not say. She could not say my name. She could only say my husband. She couldn't say our children's names. It was very hard for her to communicate. Oh yeah. It was rough. She couldn't write either. So we had to use a lot of sign, and we were basically playing charades for 2 weeks. And now I would say her speech is mostly back, but she has to speak much slower. Not much, but what's nice is she usually talked at 1.5 speed for YouTube. Now she's around back. Now she's really talking one? More at one. She's at one. So that works out well.
Okay, good.
Actually for her. So she has to, it's just a lot more difficult. She has to really put a lot more effort into speaking now. She gets lightheaded. So prayers for her, you don't feel well. You don't feel well when stuff's wrong with your brain. So that's just been a long-term thing. We're praying it's not going to be something chronic for her. And you know what? It's just hard. Once the kids are back, you're on duty again. They went to her parents' house for a few weeks. But, we've got 10, 8, and 5-year-old boys. So the house can be a little chaotic sometimes, but prayers are appreciated. And I think everyone's prayers have been really, really helpful for us and for me, because, I've got to still go to work and carry the load and be there when she's not feeling well. And it's a journey. I feel like I'm rambling so much here, Sai. There's a great skit. I think Brent Pella does this skit about MMA post-fight interviews. Like the guy who does the MMA fight and he comes out, he's been hit in the head so many times he can't give a coherent answer. So he's always like, "So how do you think the fight went?" "Well, I went out there and I went to fight and I'm a winner. And I went, I did it, and I'm here for it, and I'm a winner, Jay." It's like the blood starts rolling down. So
I think you're doing a little better than that.
A little bit.
And you so are a winner.
I'm a winner. Just came out here for all that, and I'm a winner.
So. Of the two,
I am a winner. I get to be married to Laura. She's
that's
so funny.
Right. That's right. So. And she's the beloved member of that pairing. Even the many, many people who don't like you, I think they do like Laura.
I have seen numerous comments like these online. I have seen comments people saying, "I can't stand Trent Horn. His wife Laura is funny though." So I'm like, well,
I didn't. That shows, I swear, that I didn't I even have, know you checked my comments. I didn't even. That makes me feel better that you actually read those things. I mean, I take the time to write them, and it's nice to know that you read them.
Your Fleetwood Mac lover, 1985.
Yeah, right. All right. Here's a question from Loretta. I had to fight it off, Trent. I don't know if you could feel it. I had to fight it off. How many times do you think people have said "get back, Loretta" to her? How many times do you think that has happened in her life? And I just didn't do it. I fought it. It wanted to come out so bad.
It is a hazard. And when you name, it is really hard that now when you name children and do things, you have to just, it's not just like movie quotes and things like that. It's like memes. You have to be so careful what you name your children.
Like, can you name a girl Karen anymore? I mean, people have been really mean about that. And there's a lot of lovely Karens in the world. Like, people named Karen in the world. But Karen...
I think we're going to see there's going to be this tremendous drop-off. It's sort of like how there was this Cambrian explosion in 1985 of the name Madison for girls.
Oh, yeah.
Because the movie Splash came out. There's going to be, like, an apocalyptic decline of the name Karen after, like, some viral videos went out in, like, 2018. And we just see,
just that complete drop-off.
Declining demographic.
Okay. So this one comes from Loretta, who does not need to get back home. And she says, hi, Trent.
Hello, Loretta.
What do you think a pastor of a parish can do to keep his college-bound parishioners from straying from the Catholic faith?
I think what he should do is the opportunities he has to serve, the same way you would serve the community as a whole, being present. I think especially when preaching homilies, avoiding the temptation to just preach banality, to preach just like, the generic, let's all be nice people homily. I mean, how many homilies have you heard that's always sort of boils down to, well, we're Catholics, so let's be nice. And, you know, let's try harder, everyone. That just shouldn't sound like, you know, just the same generic encouragement coach gave after practice. Because I think young people, especially, they want to be challenged. They want to hear even hard truths, but to hear that pastor really is concerned about that. That's why also I read an article recently, Cy. I want to get your take on this. I think it was a deacon or someone, trying to remember who wrote it. It was a suggestion for Pope Leo to amend canon law. I think it's canon law on this point, not the germ. Canon law says that priests are, maybe it's the germ, I can't remember, the general instruction of the Roman Missal, but that priests are strongly urged to give a homily at a daily mass if there's a sufficient number of people. And the recommendation was that it should be changed to permitted. So that way a priest would not feel a sense of guilt like they got to do a homily every single day at a daily mass, when in a lot of cases, it's not really needed. And it would free up the priest's workload to maybe focus on, I mean, Protestant pastors, they spend all week on a blockbuster Sunday sermon, you know?
Yeah.
But Catholic priests, they've got so many more things to juggle when they're preaching, when they're teaching the faith, when they're serving the community, along with everything a priest does, house calls, sacramental visits, last rites, managing a school usually. So I think that would be one thing. Before we continue with Loretta's question, though, I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I have to say, Trent, I do think, like, when people think synodality is a bad word, and people are very like, what does synodality even mean, and all that kind of stuff. But one of the things it could mean, if we chose it, like, you have to choose what you're gonna, you know, make a word mean.
Yeah.
When it's a new thing like that, is that. Parishes could be profoundly, you know, they always talk about the priest should listen more and all that. And all that stuff seems so amorphous and everything. But I don't know about the homily at Mass, but priests are doing so many things that you actually don't need a priest to do, that should just be taken over by the laity. A lot of the administrative stuff, a lot of the financial stuff, the priest should be there to govern all of that, but he shouldn't be doing it. And I think that would be
100%.
That would be 100%. A kind of positive synodality, in my view.
I wish that parishes had a chief operating officer. We have
some
that
do.
In Catholic Answers.
Some do,
yeah.
But I think priests need to be more empowered, or maybe even not empowered, but maybe bishops need to be more insistent with them. I don't want you doing this. You have sacramental responsibilities. You have all these other things. I don't want you doing X, X, and X.
Like, I would love if the priest were the one who taught RCIA, for example.
Yes, exactly, Trent. Right.
He does that. Or he's freed up to me with the youth group. So to go back to Loretta's question about college-bound parishioners, like, there I want a priest freed up so he can better serve them, so he could go spend time for a college youth group. And I think that's hard for college, especially to have. Now, it's interesting. When I was in college, our youth group was really the other college students who were part, who were the leaders of the high school youth group that would mentor the high school students. So we had kind of a built-in thing. But to have something like that for young people, and to keep the age range a little bit narrower, not 18 to 39, that's kind of broad, but to have college and post-college, to have a group dedicated to that, this also comes up too for college-bound parishioners, like let's say young men. Like, how do you get young college-age men to go to a men's group? You know how you get college-age men to not go to a parish men's group? You have the parish men's group meet at Saturday at 6:30 in the morning.
Wait, do you college want to guys guarantee? Love to get up at 5:30 exactly. on Saturday morning.
But that's the problem.
Yeah,
we need, But we need like a group to say, a men's group. And I would love for college-age Catholic men, be a part of our men's group. Come and learn about, you know, masculinity and to grow in your faith. But if it's but I know why we do it. We do it at 6:30 in the morning on Saturday because that's the least disruptive time for dad to be out of the house when kids are at home. Mm-hmm. Because weeknights, you take dad away at like 7 o'clock on a Thursday. You know, it's that's a bridge too far for many people, and understandably so. Sure. But I know I've been to parishes where they have a great young adult men's group, and that's when they meet Thursdays at 7 p.m. because that's when the guys are free. They're not at class anymore. They're off the clock at work or whatever they're doing. That's when they can meet. So to have that and to reaffirm them. So I think that especially having, like we talk about youth ministry for high school students, I'd be more apt to have high school students do family ministry with their parents involved. I talked about this at Eric Sammons, but have dedicated youth ministry, but it's for people in college. And so that's where we have Focus. We have Newman Centers. So I think the pastor working with Focus, Fellowship of Catholic University students, working with the Newman Center, Newman Society, even if they're not like near a college campus, having something like that, I think, can also be very helpful. But you got to see where they're coming from and meet the needs, meet their particular needs where they are at in their 20s, you know?
I'm going to say thank you to Loretta for the question, because I want to get another one in here. And I'm going to go to Eric Alvarez, your supporter, because I think you have time to answer this one, Trent. Hi, Trent.
Hello, Eric.
What basic book of theology do you recommend? Thanks.
Sure. At the start, I would say the Catechism of the Catholic Church, or the Compendium of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, is always a great thing to read to understand Catholic teaching laid out systematically. If you like a very good book on theology more than apologetics, though it has apologetics in it, I would recommend The Light of Christ, An Introduction to Catholicism by Thomas Joseph White. So I think that is a book that has been praised by a lot of people for presenting an approachable, systematic overview of Catholic theology. Because many people, like how I said before, Cy, that evangelism and apologetics are not the same thing. Theology and apologetics are not the same thing. Apologetics is a subset of theology. It's the rational defense of the Christian faith. Theology are just truths about God, truths about divine revelation. So you can do a lot of theology, and many people misunderstand this side. They'll become Catholic or they'll return to the faith, and all they do to grow in their faith is they just study apologetics, which is a good thing to have, but you're missing out on a lot of things to grow in your faith, to learn and grow and to be deeper and more mature, is really learning more about theology, learning about these deeper truths about God, about Christ, about the saints, about Mary and her intercession, about the sacraments, about grace, theology. Very, very important and fun, because I do apologetics all the time. Very stressful. Theology, really fun to delight in. So I would recommend that.
Eric, thank you very much for the question. Thanks for everybody who supports Trent and what he does over at the Council of Trent. Check it out, councilofTrent.com, on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. And check out Trent's brand new book. I mean, brand new book. Salvation is from the Catholic Church. How Christ uses the church to bring us to him. Trent Horn, Merry Christmas to you, Laura, and all the kids. Thanks very much. Did we lose Trent?
I'm right here, sir.
Still here. Merry Christmas. We lost you for a second.
Merry Christmas. All right. I
thought you were
Merry
a Scrooge
Christmas
there for a minute.
Well,
all right. See you tomorrow on Catholic Answers Live.